The Citadel Cafe is proudly sponsored by TweakedAudio.com. For high-performance, noise-reducing earbuds, visit TweakedAudio.com and use our code TCC at checkout for free shipping and 30% off your entire order. That's TweakedAudio.com.
This is the Citadel Cafe.
This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 133 for Wednesday, January 28th, 2015. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we're into. Cover everything from movies and television to books, apps, and websites. Joining me tonight is Mr. Bill Meeks from Greetings from Storybook, Legends of Gotham, Universe Box, which I've never heard of, so you're going to have to fill me in on that, and Dog Boy Adventures, that I do know. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Yeah, it's been quite a while. Hey, it's been like since at least summer, right?
Has it been that long? I feel like we had you on at some point in the fall.
Was it the fall? Okay, maybe yeah. I'm mistaking things. It's just, it's been too long. No matter how long it's been, if it's been a day, Joel, it's been too long. I'm glad to be back.
Flattery will get you invited back, sir.
Flattery will get you invited back. Excellent, that was the goal.
That was, yeah. No, well, it couldn't have been the summer because we took a break. TCC took a break this summer. I started back up the first week of September, so it would have been somewhere between September and Christmas, I think. But you're right, I think it was closer to kind of September, October than later on. Yeah, because I know that in the fall, I had Lou on quite a bit on the show, and that filled up quite a few weeks. And then there was like the Canadian holidays and all that kind of jazz.
I don't know, when you live in Georgia, all the seasons just kind of run together except for the one snowstorm every winter.
Yeah. Did you guys get hit with this thing that just went by with Juno?
It was a little chilly.
Yeah.
But that's about it. Yeah.
They were losing their ever-loving minds here in Halifax yesterday, and not that much happened. I mean, it was bad driving. There was very low visibility, lots of blowing snow, but there was... you know, 3 inches of snow on the ground, it's nothing. I mean, we're talking about Canada here, folks. I mean, if we don't get more than a foot and a half, then no one really kind of raises an eyebrow most of the time.
I was going to say, you guys open up the swimming pools if there's less than a foot on the ground, don't you?
Yeah, that's the ticket. The issue usually with us here in Halifax is it can flip to freezing rain really quick just because we're right on the coast and we're on a peninsula. The whole province is a giant peninsula. So we can get some very damp weather really quickly. But so far, so good. Everything was fine. It's been, the plows have been clearing. I mean, the city, actually, I have to say, the cities and streets and sidewalks have been quite clear. Mm. And there's been not lots of salt. Can't say the same for, 2 weeks ago, I was out at night and I actually fell, skinned my knee, which I haven't done since I was like 14, and ripped a hole through my jeans. It was a Saturday night. I was going to a party and I had to go to the party with a hole in my jeans cause I fell. It was an interesting, it was black ice. You know, you're just walking down the street and all of a sudden, whoosh, like all of a sudden you're on the ground. Okay.
That's the dangerous stuff. I wiped out one time in college. I remember wiping out like that and I kind of like half dislocated my shoulder, but I kind of had to just like wait for it to go back in cause I didn't have health insurance. So,
yep. Well, this brings us to a final fourth week of kicking off the show talking about the weather. I was listening back just trying to check on some quality, and I realized that this month we've been talking about the weather a lot. I think everybody's in the winter doldrums. They're all kind of like sick and tired, so they get a rant about the snow and the cold and all that kind of stuff. But tell me about Universe Box, because I've not heard about this new project that you've got going on.
Well, Universe Box, it's two things, really. One, it's the new banner I'm doing everything under. Instead of Meeks Mix Media is dead, basically.
Oh, okay.
And the company's Universe Box, and me and my wife, Anne-Marie, are all doing these podcasts, and she has a blog, and I'm doing the books all through this banner of Universe Box. And we also started a Universe Box podcast, kind of to... for brand identity purposes, I guess, but it's stories to a theme. We basically take an overarching theme every week. Like last week was home. This week is retro tech. We have cookies coming up next week and fear the week after that. And just a lot of different stories and little segments or boxes based around that theme. We do everything from I did an animated cartoon for listener Colin about home last week. And then this week we're having a calling a guest, and we also analyzed Rainbow Bright, the pilot for Rainbow Bright.
Oh, jeez.
Wow. Yeah, but it's all sorts of different segments, all based around that overarching big theme. I kind of cribbed the idea from sketch comedy shows like Mr. Show or Monty Python, where they would do like one episode about, politics or something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a good way to kind of vary it up from the fan cast we do, just because, you know, that can get a little 9 weeks in covering two shows every week, it can get a little like repetitive. So it's nice to be able to break it up a little bit too.
Yeah, really though. That's really cool. I really like the name for the company. Mm-hmm. That's a great short kind of all-encompassing name for any kind of entertainment organization, and it says entertainment. You know, I mean, universe in itself is obviously it has its own meaning, but Universe Box really, for whatever reason, just kind of screams entertainment to me. And as soon as you said what it was, I was like, oh, that makes so much more sense. Very, very
yeah,
cool.
We like it. We actually, we put a few out on we put up a poll and put it out on Twitter. I think about 50 people voted, and that was the one they decided. And I forget what the other options were. Originally, it was going to be Everything Box, because we have, from a move we did a couple times back, we have a box that we threw like all the random crap in, like as we were, you know, scrubbing the floors and everything. And anytime we needed something, it ended up being in that box. So we started calling it the Everything Box. But everythingbox.com was taken, and then we were brainstorming and came up with Universe Box, which is more universe-y.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think it's definitely something that will go places as far as the brand recognition is concerned.
Oh, yeah.
Do you guys, are you doing a lot of animation? Like you mentioned, like some animated stuff happening in the calling in for the show. Like, because that's in my neck of the woods now.
Oh yeah, well, not too much really. It's it just seemed like it would fit really well for the story we got in from one of our listeners, Wu S. Kim. But it's really just simply animation. What I did is, I don't know if you know this, but in my freelancing time, I did quite a bit of animation. In fact, all the work I did for about a year and a half was animation. But it's really simple, like stick figure kind of things. And then what I did is I went in and I drew the backgrounds on my iPad in that paper application to kind of give it sort of like a brush kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
Because my old tablet that it took up to the computer to draw busted. Like it's broken now. It doesn't work anymore.
Right.
So I was like, hey, I'll just use the iPad. And then I imported those in and everything. So it's a real simple animation, but it was kind of fun. I know we'll definitely do more in the future. It's a matter of bandwidth for me because, you know, I have a full-time job and everything too.
Yeah.
So it just happened that I had the stick figure models already done from a freelancing project several years ago and already all rigged in After Effects ready to go. So it was really easy to just hop in there and do it.
Oh, okay. After Effects. Because I was trying to remember. I remember you had showed me something that you had done a long time ago, and I was remembering kind of like an After Effects motion graphic-y type situation. But yeah, I've always wanted to learn how to do work in After Effects, just because I see the mind-blowing work that happens in the Blizzard shorts that they put out on YouTube that are After Effects animated paintings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of like an animated storyboard. Such a cool concept. And something that I miss about animation is telling a story with motion, but I don't miss 24 drawings a second. Like for classical, I don't miss having to draw 720 frames. I mean, I know there's holds and stuff in there too, but like I just that much mental creative computing power to get a minute. Like, yeah, it was never my favorite thing. The reward was amazing, but it was getting there was always just like, oh my God, this took all week.
You know? Oh yeah, even just doing it like the easy peasy cheap way in After Effects takes forever.
Yeah. So, I mean. Yeah, yeah. Well, because I mean, you're probably like me, like you have a certain vision and you want it to look exactly at that as that vision goes and all that kind of stuff. Yeah,
And then you end up throwing out the comp and starting over again from scratch. I can do it better this time.
Yeah, yeah. The issue that I have, it's one part time saver and one part not. When I learned animation, I was on paper, and we were putting it on pegboards, photographing it, and testing it on the computer. Then we, you know, when I moved into being an animator professionally, we were working in Flash, and I was still doing classical animation. It was still hand-drawn. We were just using Flash just for the light table digital features, as well as being able to play back your animation immediately. So to do that allowed you to quickly check your animation, but then all animators just really love seeing their work move. So you kind of spend a lot of time checking the work and watching it over again. And we ended up, I remember on one of my very first productions, we had to kind of set a rule in the studio. It's like, look, if you watch it 3 times and you don't see any mistakes, it's good. It's approved. We got to move on. Because people would just, they would nitpick and they would get down. And the end result would be wonderful. Like, you'd end up with very, very good animation. But the problem is it was taking everybody too long because they would be spending too much time reviewing stuff.
I've always had a bit of a problem with that too, like going back and reviewing and reviewing and reviewing. After so many times, you stop noticing everything about it. It becomes flat to you. You don't even notice the flaws, which can be dangerous. Or you know, new flaws that get added in that you don't realize because you're so focused on, oh, that guy's mustache has to wiggle just right, and then you don't notice that you chopped off his ear for something. You
know? Yeah. I've certainly had that experience. I used to be a supervising animator, so I was the guy that has not been looking at the scene all day long and would get called in to check it out and pick out the mistakes and stuff like that. And I used to be really picky. I remember one time we were working on a superhero show, and one of the frames, someone had forgot to color like the sleeve. So like a character sleeve, it was like a dog character and he had a brown arm and a red sleeve. And on one frame, the sleeve was brown because they had forgot to color it. And I was like, back up 3 frames, you missed a spot. And this animator who was right out of school and sure as, you know, the north wind was just like, what are you talking about? I didn't miss anything. I said, back up 3 frames, you missed a sleeve. And sure enough, he missed a sleeve. He's like, how the hell did you see that? I was like, dude, it's just my OCD kicking in. And two, it's just, I've been doing this a while. it was a funny, funny moment. But speaking of superheroes, we can kind of, I guess, mosey into what we've been watching. And we've actually watched the same program, which was Superheroes, A Never-Ending Battle, a 3-part PBS documentary on superheroes and comic culture that I caught on Netflix. And immediately after watching it, I knew I had to talk about it on this show. And I knew I had to get you, Bill, to come on the show and talk about it with me, because knowing that we're just such big Superman fans, you even more so than I am.
I'm branded. I have the tattoo and everything.
Nice. I really liked the series. It was so well done. And I had never heard about it until I stumbled upon it on Netflix. So did you know about this before I'd sent it to you? Like, had you seen it before?
Well, I actually, because I popped in the dock this morning and saw it in there, and I had never heard of it, or I hadn't thought I'd ever heard of it. And then I went over to Netflix and I hit play on it. I was like, yeah, I'll watch that because that'll be fun to talk about. And it was halfway through. So I must have watched it when I was falling asleep one night or something.
Nice.
And never finished it. But no, I finished it today and it was really good. I really enjoyed it. There were some things I didn't like about it, but that isn't the fault of the documentary. It's the fault of the people in it.
Okay. So this, something that we can hold that thought because I want to go back on that, because that's where I don't have the knowledge to know where things are not correct, or like the people in it are speaking either ill or out of turn. Something that I really liked about it though was just the general kind of message. I mean, it was as much for the average comic geek as it was for someone that knows nothing about comics. Like, they really kind of explained a lot of the basics. A lot of the first episode I knew. Like, I know enough about comic history to know the old history. You know, like the origins of Superman, Joe Shuster and, why am I blanking on his name?
Jerry Siegel.
Like, I mean, I knew about that. I knew about the starting of Marvel and then how Image spun off and Todd McFarlane and all. Like, I knew about that kind of general stuff. But where my comic knowledge gets foggy is in the 80s. because I was an 80s kid, but I was an 80s animation kid. I wasn't big into comics again until it was the 90s when Image was out there. And those were the books that I was reading. It was like,
ironically, a lot of the people who were writing those cartoons you were watching in the 80s were comic book writers.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Actively working in the field, like Marv Wolfman, Cary Bates, yeah, all those guys.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So it was really cool to see that bit of the 80s and then even into 2000. One of the things that I felt spoke to me about the documentary, I think it was in the third one, cause it's a 3-part series. Was about the 9/11 situation and how comics had to then be once again rewritten to attack a different kind of cultural, I guess we'll call it a cultural concern, I guess. Basically the same way that Superman and Captain America rose to crazy stardom in and around the Second World War, when, you know, we'll say America needed, you know, those kinds of heroes, all of these things had to be kind of retooled and rewritten after the attacks in New York on September 11th. And I just thought it was so cool to see like these different messages and different things happening. Like there was a Vietnam sort of situation where, again, there was a shift. And I thought it was so cool that they touched on all of those different outside culture things affecting how comics were written. And it's only because I didn't really, saturate myself with 80s comics that I saw, like, I didn't see that shift. Right. Mm-hmm. And I've never read the really old ones, and this is going to sound awful, but I'm kind of an art snob. Like, I just can't go back and read the really cheesy ones because they're just not for me. I respect them, but they're just not something I want to sit down and read. I'm sure that if I went back and read the stuff that I was reading in the 90s, it was just as cheesy. I'm sure that it's just an impression thing, not so much a reality. But I really enjoyed the series. It really kind of made me want to go create a superhero or draw a superhero. And I couldn't turn it off. I watched all three of them in the course of a day and a half.
Nice.
Yeah. So what were the things that you felt were, I guess, lacking, or things that were contradicting things that you know about comic culture?
I think it was really all in the framing, like, because I mean, I've heard accounts of particularly that 90s time you were talking about where Image broke off from the main guys, and, you know, indie comics were big and the speculator market happened and everything, and they really frame the Image guys as like the heroes riding in on white horses, particularly Todd McFarlane. And he kind of paints himself that way too.
Yeah. You don't really get the impression that he's a likable guy.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. He's one of those very successful jerks that is, you know, talented, but he's still a jerk.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. Not knowing him personally, but that's the impression that I get.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, anecdotally, that's what I've heard about him too.
Mm-hmm.
But in my estimation, those guys, yes, they did a lot for creators' rights and everything back in that period, as far as like, getting some back end on stuff. If you create an original character for one of the big two, they'll give you some money. Like, you know, if, I don't know, Victor Zsasz shows up on Gotham, they'll give the guy a check, whoever created him.
Mm-hmm.
Their type of art and the variant covers and the holographic covers and everything, that really that group, like Todd McFarlane, Rob Liefeld, all those guys, and Jim Lee, really pushed and really like took out to the forefront and made successful, created the speculators market, which almost sunk the entire comic books industry a couple years later.
Right.
It, like, obviously, you know, when it was big and they were making tons and tons of money, but it fell off real fast. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they really touched on that as much as I would have liked to have seen, how those guys almost killed the comic book industry at the same time as they were helping creators get a leg up, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I certainly remember their march forward with the art. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the main reasons that I was into Image comics when I was younger, 12 to 14 kind of situation, was because the art was so cool looking, and because it was printed and colored on computers, and it just, it was shiny. Like, it looked real in terms of not so much like proportions and drawing, but just lighting and rendering and stuff looked a lot closer to what I was seeing in Hollywood films than it did in the old kind of print comics that were still doing like tones and CMYK. What's the word I'm looking for? Like, I wouldn't even begin to speculate how the older ones were colored.
Yeah, I remember, like, I know at first it was something like there were four inks they could use, and mm-hmm. and every color was a combination of those four. It was two or three, like, back, I don't know. I'm not a printer, Joel.
Yeah.
I'm just a comic book fan.
Yeah, but I'm sure anybody that, I mean, hey, if you're a comic book aficionado and you want to correct me, please let me know. And I do know about four-color printing, and I know that, you know, there were some, like, tones and scratch papers and stuff like that that they would use. I mean, pen and ink is always straightforward. So the black and whites, I knew how the things were drawn. But it just felt like people at Image knew how to use Photoshop and no one else did. You know what I mean? Like, just it had that kind of that glossy feel that you get with so much concept art these days. And I mean, comics that I read that are exclusively start to finish painted in Photoshop and look amazing. And that kind of art just pulled me in. And then I was into a lot of those team comics. It was like Cyberforce and Strike Force and Stormwatch, and basically there was, like, you know, some rough and tumble leader. There was the loose cannon, usually had a lot of knives. There was the gigantic guy. There was the fast guy or girl. There was another team of villains. Often the villains had more women, kind of like banshee type characters, and just kind of very, they're all, like, not for lack of a better term, they're all bitches. Like, they're just really mean, nasty people that would really willing to kill anybody to get ahead. And these teams of 5-on-5 often went at each other. And there was always, like, a counterpart. You know, like, there was the big guy on one side and there was the big, nasty, bad guy and all this kind of stuff. And there were some interesting concepts, which I thought was really cool, too. This one character, Striker, I remember, had three arms on one side and one arm on the other. It was kind of cool. Oh,
that's crazy.
Yeah, it was neat.
I think a lot of those were actually, like, a lot of these artists and every, because, I mean, it had always been more of a writer's medium before the 90s, and then it became very, very much an artist medium. And I think it was a situation where they were like, guys, these comics are selling like hotcakes. We need more characters. So they're, like, going back and pulling out their art school notebooks where they created, like, 100 superheroes while they were listening to lectures or whatever. Here's a Leopard Panther Man guy.
Yeah, exactly. And some of them were coming out at the same time or shortly thereafter, and you can correct me on the timing on this, as some of the classic characters like Superman and Batman were kind of still in the cheesy realm. Like, there was a point there, and right up until, I want to say, Frank Miller did The Dark Knight Returns, Batman was pretty cheesy because there was the television show with Adam West.
I would say it probably, a lot of people credit Frank Miller with returning Batman to his roots. I really think it was more Denny O'Neill, if you know him.
I've certainly heard it. I would probably recognize the books to see them.
But he's the guy who really, in the 70s, he was one of the head honchos at DC Comics, and he kind of did a big revamp on Batman and Superman. Superman, he did some stuff where he took away his weakness to kryptonite and all the stuff, and it really wasn't all that good. But it kind of buoyed the character until the 80s and Crisis happened and everything. But Batman, Denny O'Neill came in, and he had grown up on the original comics that were a bit darker. And then he had been in college and stuff when the whole Batman TV show was going on, and it was this big countercultural satirical revolution kind of thing.
Right.
And he really enjoyed that aspect of it, but at the same time, he thought that the character had gone too far, because what they were doing in the comics was they were trying to do the Batman and Robin on the TV show without the intelligent commentary that, you know, was part and parcel of the goofiness of that show. So they were doing Batman, but they weren't doing it. They were doing a goofy Batman, but they weren't doing it smart to a point. And Denny O'Neill kind of wanted to bring it back to its roots. So when he took over the book, he decided to make it to where, for one, Batman can't be out during the day at all. Every scene has to take place at night.
Right.
We want him in the shadows. We want that cape that he has behind there that is just kind of hanging there, like a little 4-foot cape that looks like a kid on Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we start moving that thing and, like, having it be a part of his character? you know, and it, just that, and then kind of introducing darker characters and darker themes. Like, I believe that's where Ra's al Ghul comes from, and that's really when the Scarecrow hit its stride. I think he'd appeared before that, but in that 70s period, and I think that's really... That really is the transition period that allowed Frank Miller to do Dark Knight Returns and Batman Year One and everything, and you know, do the deconstructed sort of superhero version of it. But I really think I really credit Denny O'Neil with bringing back the Bat as he is now. You know.
Yeah, I looked him up while you were talking. He was in the documentary.
Oh, was it? Yeah, I think he was. I think I remember seeing him.
Yeah, no, he's definitely he's certainly in the second and third parts for sure. The names flashed up kind of quick on screen. Actually, if the only real complaint about the documentary is that the information they throw at you is just so fast, unless you're willing to pause it and look stuff up on Wikipedia as you're going, it's kind of hard to take in everybody's name because they do talk to a lot of different people.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not really always clear, that they're talking to a writer or an artist. You know, they just kind of say, oh, this is, you know, Denny O'Neil. Well, if you don't know who that is, then it would be nice. Like, it would be nice, instead of just someone coming up on screen and their name coming below, it would be really cool if the narrator had mentioned something, you know, had said, you know, oh, this is, you know, one of the things that happened, blah, 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 and introduce kind of Denny O'Neil. I remember
like show some of their work or something in a split screen or something.
Yeah. Well, sometimes they did. There was one guy that was drawing, some of the older guys, they had them at drawing tables, and it was amazing because, I mean, these guys look like they're having a hard time just existing, and yet they've got a brush in their hand, and they're, like, cross-hatching a Captain America drawing. I just, you know, stuff like that was just incredible to see. Denny O'Neil, I remember liking a lot of what he said, and it wasn't until, I think it was 1986, that The Dark Knight Returns came out.
Yeah, I believe I know it was mid-80s. It was 85 or 86.
Yeah.
Oh, which by the way, one of my favorite parts of this entire thing was when they had Adam West reading the dialogue from Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah. Yeah, it was goofy, right?
Oh, yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah, I really liked how they did some of that. You know, they had some characters kind of getting in there and talking about stuff. I was kind of hoping, because the third series had even glimpses of Man of Steel, I feel like there was just a couple of clips, but must have been from the trailer, because it didn't... I was hoping they were going to talk to more of the actors that played Superman. We got a couple of clips of Christopher Reeves before he passed, but not anybody else. I would have been really curious to hear what Dean Cain might have had to say. Same thing with... there's a really fun YouTube video of all the people that have voiced or played Superman being part of a Superman club.
Oh yeah, the that's from the Tim Daly
Web series. Yeah, and it's very, very funny, because to me, like, Tim Daly is my animated Superman, just as much as Kevin Conroy is my animated Batman. I just, the voice is just kind of one and the same now for me.
There's one I like a little better, but he's great. He's absolutely great
for Batman.
For Superman.
Superman. Oh, who do you like better for Superman?
It's from the Ruby Spears Superman show in the 80s, but it's basically a direct adaptation of the comic books at the time. It's done by all the writers are the same, and all the stories have the same kind of structure, and that's like my ideal Superman. Like, the ideal form of Superman is the 80s Superman written by Kerry Bates, and that's what the show is, so it has to be my favorite.
It's interesting. I don't think I've ever heard about that one.
Oh, yeah. It's like super rare, and it took me years to track it down, but I found it at a Cracker Barrel gift shop, actually, like last year.
No kidding.
Yeah, on DVD, sitting there on DVD. It was like $21. I was like, I don't care. And it's like 10 episodes. I was like, I don't care. I'll buy it because I've been looking for this thing forever.
Well, geez, there's a lot of people that have voiced Superman. Tim Daly, George Newbern. George Newbern, really? Wow. That's interesting. I feel like George Newbern gets very close to Tim Daly. I have a hard time telling them apart. There's been a lot of different guys. I'm surprised. Kyle MacLachlan, really? I'm on a page that just kind of lists them all. And,
well, the thing is, now they do all those animated DVD movies with DC, so everyone has a different version of the characters in it, almost. So. So all sorts of actors get a chance to voice Superman.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun.
Alan Tudyk has done it from Firefly. That's really? Wow.
Which one was he in?
That's the new one, Justice League War 2014.
Oh, okay.
That just came out this month.
I didn't like that one that much.
I haven't watched it yet. I've been waiting because I've been waiting.
Actually, I think War was the last one that came out that was based on the new 52 Justice League. And then the one that came out this month was Throne of Atlantis.
You're right. You're right. And yeah. I did see War. And the War was very anime-like. And Superman, of course, mm-hmm. got the new suit, which is dumb. I don't know why they can't. They can do all these, like all the animated features, even after they did the new 52, some of the direct-to-DVD animated features have a suit that is reminiscent of the Superman animated series suit.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason now, the new animations are going towards the new 52 suit, which just, I don't like the high collar. It makes him look too military.
See, I also don't like, especially in Justice League, like in Action Comics, he was pretty good, but I don't like the characterization of Superman in that. Just because he's a bit too cocky for Superman,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, they often voice him and write him too young.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like it when Batman and Superman are about the same age, Batman being a couple years senior, but not a lot. You know, they're both kind of mid-30s, whereas this 20-something Superman is kind of hard to take. I agree with you. I think that's it's a bit much. Something else I really liked about the documentary was just how earnest Jim Lee spoke about the origins of stuff. Like, everybody is talking like it's the most imaginary, like, fantastic, wonderful, creative thing. And he's just like, I was just looking for things that rhymed. Fantastic Four. That sounds amazing. You know, just Excelsior. He was totally branding at the same time that he was coming up with the stuff, and them talking about like how everybody was scared of nuclear war. You know, so he's like, well, this is what's happening. We've put a man on the moon, and we don't know what's up there. So let's go with gamma rays. I don't know what a gamma ray is. I couldn't tell you what a microwave is. But it sounds pretty cool, and if it sounds cool, I'm putting it in a comic. Like, it was just so fun. I forget, because I'm guilty of this too. I take my comic characters seriously. If things are goofy, I'm not big on the goofy. Like, I don't watch Batman: Brave and the Bold. I know it's a good show. I'm sure it's fantastic and funny, but it's not the Batman that I want. I want the Dark Knight, not the Dark Knight Returns, but like I really like the Batman animated series. Like, there's some funny moments, but they're more like Batman's doing something dark and satirical and smirking, not like he's cracking jokes and puns and stuff like that. And I do like, same thing with my Superman. Like, if the shows and the episodes of the animated series in Superman that I didn't like were all the ones that dealt with like really goofy magic, like Mixlipiclick and all that kind of stuff. Like, not even the least interested. Now, put him up against Lex
Luthor.
Hey, Joel,
you want to know who my favorite Superman villain is? It rhymes with Bix Biz Biddle Bick.
Really? Interesting. Yes. I did not know that. See, now I don't know him from the comics. I only know him from the show. So it was probably written pretty kiddie. But
it's actually the one from the animated series is actually pretty close to the original, which is Mixlipiclick. I think just Mixlipiclick.
Yeah.
I can't talk. But it was slightly different name.
Yeah.
But pretty accurate.
They put that character in Smallville, too.
But it was like Michael Mixlipiclick or something.
Yeah, it was like a Polish last name or something like that. They kind of twisted it a little bit. But I really enjoyed how Jim Lee was talking about just how they invented all this stuff and how they kind of came up with the characters. And it's like, hey, that sounds like it's going to go well. And you know, the idea of taking the Marvel approach, which is more about realistic characters and as far as like being able to relate to them, like Peter Parker being a good example of like, hey, he's a teenager. You know, shit happens. Like, he does not have a great life outside of Spider-Man. Like, Spider-Man kind of ruins Peter Parker's social life and being a kid and trying to do well in school and just all being up late fighting crime and all this kind of stuff. And I thought it was a really kind of neat way to differentiate between like it's a very broad line, but it's a very clear line between what Marvel kind of does and what DC does.
I like I mean, in a sense, I guess. But I mean, DC had those kinds of stories back in that corny period you were talking about. You know, in the 50s and 60s, they had some great stories that kind of were about the weaknesses of the heroes, like their personal weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's one that always comes to mind for me that's called Superman's New Power. And basically what happens is he gets exposed to some space rock or something. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But he ends up growing this little tiny like 4-inch Superman that he can shoot out of his wrist to go deal with problems. And it turns out that this little tiny Superman is way better at being Superman than the big Superman is. And he gets like this complex over it. And it's one of the most amazing stories I've ever read. Superman's New Power. I definitely recommend it. But, you know, in another takeaway I had from this whole documentary really is just because they were kind of doing it like that. They were like, this is how DC was doing. This is how Marvel was doing. This is DC. This is Marvel. I think DC, for the most part, they kind of pushed the medium forward in a lot of ways by taking big risks. Like, for one, no one since World War II had done a superhero team book before they did Justice League. And then within a year, Marvel was doing Fantastic Four and Avengers.
Right.
You know, so DC broke the ground and then Marvel kind of processed it and made it palpable for, you know, the masses. DC kind of makes counterculture and then Marvel turns it into pop culture, more or less.
It's a good way of thinking about it. It's funny, like when I think about DC and I think about superheroes, it's funny because what comes to mind is like these really grand ideas like Superman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern. Like they're fighting against the universe. Like it is just completely out there. And I understand that happens in Marvel too. Like I understand, you know, like Thor is obviously from a different galaxy and they've got I can't remember what it was called, not the invasion. It was something about Marvel where there was aliens.
I can't remember. The Kroll Wars?
The Kroll Wars or something like that. But it was Marvel Invasion. I feel like it was Marvel Invasion. I could be wrong. But like, I know that they do that kind of stuff. And it's like grand staging, you know, for Marvel. But when I think Marvel, I think Tony Stark, you know, real guy with a suit. I think Spider-Man, real kid with some real problems that has superpowers. Like I don't necessarily think about like Superman, who's like very godlike, you know. Same thing with Wonder Woman. Like I don't go as high as that immediately. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously if you dig into both, they've both got characters. Well, I mean, Batman doesn't have any superpowers. And you don't necessarily think of him. Well, I guess people do now just because he's part of the Justice League and he's got that kind of clout, but like, you don't really think about him being godlike. Mm-hmm. In terms of a superhero versus Superman and Wonder Woman. I kind of think of Batman along the same lines as Tony Stark and Spider-Man in terms of like fallible characters and people with some real issues that are doing some unique things with their nightlife. But, you know, I find that it's such a weird kind of initial gut reaction to when someone says Marvel and when someone says DC, like what's the first thing that comes to mind? And I thought that the documentary did a really good job of kind of pointing out, well, actually, there's quite a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's obviously some big differences, but there's a lot of similarities. And I was disappointed that they didn't really get into a lot of the indie stuff, but I guess that's because it was not necessarily a comic documentary. It was about superheroes.
And then again, a lot of the indie stuff isn't really superheroes. You know, if it's a lot of indie stuff actually rejects superheroes and says, you know, superheroes are shit around here.
You'd see, they mentioned it once or twice in the documentary about the anti-hero, you know, like the Punisher, stuff like that. And it would have been cool to see some of the anti-hero stuff from indie comics. I feel like the Max was one.
Yeah, Max was, well, I mean, like, I think in the 90s, every hero was basically an anti-hero.
Yeah.
I mean, like every hero was busting skulls all up and down the street every day.
Yeah, Spawn, I guess, would be a really good example.
Mm-hmm. I actually something Todd McFarlane said, which I didn't really like him overall in the documentary, but something he said actually made me consider picking up a Spawn book. I've never read one. But I didn't realize that Spawn, the more he used his powers, like I didn't realize that would eventually kill him or whatever. But when Todd McFarlane mentioned that, I was like, oh, maybe I should pick up an issue or two of this, maybe.
Yeah, I haven't read a lot of them. I remember some because I really enjoyed the Angela storylines, and I had the first crossover just because it was available when I was collecting comics. I thought, you know what, I'll pick this up because this is probably going to be worth something someday, which I'm sure it's not.
Oh, yeah, I didn't say I've never owned a Spawn comic book. I just said I've never read one.
Oh, so yeah, I've got the first kind of Spawn Batman crossover. And that's how they introduced him, was there's this crossover with Batman, which I thought was kind of interesting. I remember, again, I really like the art. I like kind of the over-the-top. McFarlane's style at the time reminds me a lot of World of Warcraft. Like, it was just chains and spikes and steel and just very aggressive stuff. A lot of detail. It just looks really, really cool. And I like the, I want to say it was kind of like a mature read as far as like, you know, Hellspawn and demons and the devil and, he's dead, but he's not dead. And
cursing and sexual situations.
Yeah. That kind of stuff. Yeah. Have you seen the MTV, animated series Spawn?
I've seen clips from it. I remember seeing various clips from it. And stuff,
it's worth checking out. It's worth checking out. I mean, the example that they do the same thing. It's the first series, the first story, is it for sure is at least covered, and they do a good job in the documentary you're talking about it, where McFarlane wasn't afraid to kill the villain. So instead of the villain always getting away, or the hero always saving the day, Spawn was after a pedophile, and he eventually, after failing to catch him, you know, and some people getting harmed, he does catch the pedophile and he kills him in a very brutal way. And it was just one of those things where Marion's like, no one's ever done that, you know? Mm-hmm. And he was speaking of it in a very cocky manner, which makes you kind of dislike the story. But if you just kind of take McFarlane out of it and realize what it was actually like, all right, you know, it's all fantasy, but it's kind of like that thing where, you know, you hear about someone that is a pedophile that's been jailed, released, and then they just repeat, and you're just like, not that I'm condoning putting these people to death, but like in a comic book situation where it is fantasy, I can see where the same sort of, you know, fantasies about heroes and anti-heroes rising up, maybe not really on America's side during Watergate and during Vietnam and all that kind of stuff, and stuff that you'll see in those books. I can see how comics like the ones that McFarlane was writing were kind of battling with society trying to process that kind of crime that was happening and hitting the news a lot. And it was an interesting look at what, when some people are allowed off the reins, like what, or off the leash, like what they'll do and what they could do and what that kind of speaks to as far as the culture was concerned at the time.
Yeah, I definitely think that boundary sort of pushing is very important, especially, you know, to open up the medium. I think sometimes they can get a little excessive with it, especially back then, especially in the 90s. A lot of like the violence and stuff got a little excessive, and it wasn't to a point. But I think it was very necessary, because, you know, in the 80s, as they discussed in the documentary, you had things like Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen and stuff that were really blowing open the kinds of topics you could cover in a comic book. And, you know, along with that was more adult stuff, you know, sexual situations, more complex themes, stuff like that. And so that was all well and good. And then, but in order to do that, because, I mean, the comic code was still around, people still considered comic books for kids, you had to demonstrate literary value to what you were doing and the choices you were making, mm-hmm. For it to be acceptable, for it not to cause a controversy. And if nothing else, what those Image guys did, I mean, not to say that their work doesn't have literary value. I'm sure it does to some degree. Like, you know, I haven't read a lot of the books. But really more what it did was kind of push it out there to where anyone can use these tools in their tool chest. I think in it, part of the reason why I think the market kind of went right towards the end there was just because they were using just those tools in their tool chest instead of, you know, building really compelling characters or compelling plots or working with big themes or anything. They were just throwing curse words and boobs on the page because it was selling. You know, so I think that was a bad thing ultimately for the industry, and something the industry is still dealing with today. You know, what with hyper sexualized covers when it's not really part of the story. And
something that I know I've mentioned before in the show too is just like even covers that have nothing to do with what's inside. Mm-hmm. You know, like guest covers and stuff like that. It's just it's like, well, I think it's really cool that's, you know, Scotty Young has done the cover. What I really want to see is Scotty Young do the whole book. And if he hasn't done the whole book, the fact that he's on the cover is really going to get me excited and get me really disappointed when I open up the book and realize that, oh no, it's actually by somebody else. You know, like that. I mean, who might be just as talented. And it, you know, it's just that I have a certain expectation when I see the cover of a book. You know, I remember what it was. I was talking about the cover art for DC animated films. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's directly related to the design of the film, and sometimes it's not at all.
Like, give me an example of one that's not.
Dark Knight Returns. The cover art for the Dark Knight Returns DVD cases, the movies on Netflix, it doesn't, the poster doesn't look a damn thing like the show. Not that the show looks bad. I like the show. I really enjoyed the style of the animation. I thought they did very well with it. Mm-hmm. But again, it's like, whoa, wow, this looks incredible. And it's like, no, it doesn't look anything like that.
That doesn't even look an awful lot like Dark Knight Returns.
No,
like
at all. Exactly, right? I mean, and there could be something in the background. There could be like licensing, like they couldn't get it, they couldn't do it, they couldn't afford it. Like, I don't know.
That looks like a cover for the new Arkham game or something, not Dark Knight.
Exactly, right? So that's the kind of stuff that I always found a little bit messy. But you can talk about, like, you know, putting, you know, sexy looking superheroes on the cover or funny situations, stuff like that. And I always find that a little bit misleading. I mean, 12-year-old Joel didn't mind. Because, I mean, all of the superheroes that I was reading at that age were all in, like, spandex and or cyborg, so that it didn't really matter. Like, they were metal, so they didn't really need clothes. Like, it was very...
They were sexy robots. It's okay to say, Joel.
Yeah.
They were sexy robots.
Sexy robots.
Yeah, and you know, also, you know, don't take any sort of impression from this that I'm super, like, puritanical or anything like that, because I'm totally not.
Oh, no.
It's just a situation where variety is the spice of life, and sometimes limitations can inspire creativity too. You know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And for me, I don't necessarily, I mean, like, sure, hey, you know, I like a sexy superhero just as much as the next guy or girl. Mm-hmm. But I find that sometimes, especially if I know some stuff that I've seen from the 90s, as even some of my own art, as I grew up emulating that kind of stuff where, you know, like the anatomy is just wrong. Like just, that's just not even possible. And I
like that one, Rob Liefeld picture of Captain America, for example,
yes.
Where his torso is three times as thick as his head.
Yeah. Yeah. Stuff like that, is always interesting. I mean, it's a little different when you're dealing with something like the Hulk. But when it's supposed to be a man, you know, like I remember my reaction when I saw the first Superman animated series, and like, quote, it was, I am so glad that they finally drew him like a house. Like I was just so happy that Superman wasn't just a strong average looking guy, that he looked like a beast. I mean, I find it kind of funny that, you know, he didn't look any smaller when he was Clark Kent. but still, like, I really like the fact that he has this giant chest and these great big broad shoulders in the cartoon. And, I mean, that in an exaggerated animated style makes sense, but in the comics, like, I don't know. I like the fact that for the most part, you know, if you're going to design these superheroes, if you design for function versus kind of attractiveness and stuff like that. Like, I remember those team comics I talked about, Cyberforce. Velocity was the name of a young character. She was probably like kind of in her mid-teens, high school type age. And she could run really fast. That was her superpower. She was just like lightning fast. And she was petite. She did not have big boobs. She didn't have a big curvy butt. She had pretty thick looking legs, but not in a, in a like heavy set kind of way. She was just, she looked like she was built for speed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the issue that I have when they draw the Flash. That's when he's really built up top, like when he's really broad. There was there was a series of the Justice League cartoon where everybody was just this giant triangle, no matter who they were. The Batman, Superman, Green Lantern, Flash, all of them were the same triangle model. It's kind of like, no, some of these guys should be petite and agile and flipping all over the place, and some of them should be giant powerhouses, and they didn't seem to get that right. One of my favorite characters that they did get right on more often than not was Cyborg. I often like the way that they handle him.
See, I'm not a huge fan of the Cyborg character, but just because he's never made an appearance in a book that he's stood out to me as a good character or like a character that I really glommed onto. I'm sure there's a Cyborg story out there I just need to read, but it gets a little bit of annoying because they're trying to like kind of shoehorn him in to be like one of the big top DC heroes always, like he's always been there. And I'm like, come on, if you're going to make him the big top hero, make him the new big top hero and market it that way.
Yeah.
You know, but don't be like, yeah, you know, the Justice League, Superman, Batman, Cyborg.
Yeah. He's in the cartoons because he deals with the internet and cyber culture, and he's quote unquote hip. He's really, honestly, in the animated series, he's just obnoxious. He's like, oh, I just hacked into your mental neural net with my nano cyber blah, 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 blah. He's like, dude, you don't sound cool at all. Not in the least. Well, speaking about all these heroes and comic books and stuff like that, have you been reading anything cool over the last little while since we've had you on the show?
Reading? I did actually just finish a book here. Probably about 2 weeks ago, I read it when we were on a vacation up north. And it's a really good book, probably my favorite time travel story I've ever read. After reading it, I'm like, this is probably the top time travel story I've ever read. It's called The Man Who Folded Himself by David Gerrold. It's this really cool story. Basically what happens is the main character, he's like dealing with a dying uncle. The uncle dies and leaves him this time belt, which allows him to travel through time. And he does like one quick little test of like 5 minutes. To see how it works and everything. And when he lands, another version of himself appears, and it's himself from the following day who's traveled back to talk to himself right after finding the time belt. And right away, they throw out any sort of like, you know, the basic rules of time travel, like you can't change things irrevocably and all that. So they throw it all out. They say paradoxes are fine. And the story we're following is the guy who found the belt on page one, and that's the version of the character we'll follow through the entire book. So you don't have to worry about being confused. You're following the same guy the entire time. Paradoxes can happen. Realities can be erased. No big deal, right? Because it's all from the perspective of the main character. And it's insane. He travels all throughout history, all throughout all different periods of his life, sets up different houses in different time periods, forms relationships, both friendships and romantic relationships, with his past, present, and alternate reality selves, some romantic. It's just insane, mind-bending sci-fi fun with a good bit to say about life in general and kind of the cycle of life, the circle of life, if you will.
No kidding.
And it was so good, and it's a short read, too. I think I did the audiobook, and I think it was 4 hours, maybe.
Oh, that is short.
But yeah, I just walked away from it feeling great about life and everything, and just a little confused in points too, but in a good way, you know.
So it's instead of the circle of life, it's the infinity loop of life.
Yeah, pretty much.
Nice.
The Man Who Folded Himself, really good.
David Gerrold. With two R's, yeah, right on. Mm-hmm. Well, that brings us to the Internet Minute, which is sponsored by Tweaked Audio. You can visit tweakedaudio.com for high-performance, noise-reducing earbuds. Use the code TCC at checkout for free shipping and 30% off your entire order. Tweakedaudio.com, that code again is TCC. Well, I've got a couple of picks this week. One of them I'm feeling like I might have mentioned on the show before, and it's called Gary Chang's Extreme Transformer Room. It's a YouTube video. It's an interview with a Chinese architect and designer. He lives in an apartment that's 344 square feet in Hong Kong, something that he inherited from his parents. And the whole thing moves walls fold in, fold out. He can pull out and have a kitchen. He can transform his couch into his bed. The bed folds down from the wall. He's got a huge stand-in shower, and he's got a bathtub that's hidden behind the laundry room. Like it's a very cool 10-minute video if you've got the 10 minutes to watch it. It makes you really kind of...
Yeah, the whole apartment's just... Oh, I was just going to say the whole apartment's like a big Tetris game or Jenga set or something.
Yeah, everything's hung on tracks in the ceiling, and he said that they're not proprietary, like they're inexpensive. You can buy them. I mean, when he says inexpensive, I don't exactly know what he's dealing with for money, but like it's obviously something that is purchasable. You don't have to like design these things custom. And then to hide them, he's put mirrors in the ceiling, which again makes the space feel even larger. One of the things that he mentioned is that in the middle of the room, because of these walls all take up some space along with his storage, and he has a lot of storage. It's just very well planned. He also doesn't have, I want to say he doesn't have a lot of stuff. He has a lot of stuff that can fit on shelves. He doesn't have a lot of large things. Like he doesn't have floor lamps. He doesn't have a lot of like table lamps. Those kind of things tend to be really small or built in. So like the light is in the ceiling or built into the shelf, that sort of thing.
And everything's functional too versus like decorative.
Yes, precisely. Although things are very aesthetically pleasing too.
Oh yeah.
I mean, the shower is ginormous. It's one of these things that you can kind of turn around in, and it's got like a shower head on the wall, but then it also has like the rain shower head right ahead. Like it's probably the shower itself is probably 4 foot by 4 foot. Like it's a pretty large room. But the thing is that when you've got all the things squared away, if he wants to have company over, he's got 180 square feet of open nothing in the middle of the apartment, right? So it's still a large room to have, you know, 10 or 20 people over for a small gathering. Like it's not like you're walking around stuff all the time. There's no couch in the middle. There's no chairs. Like all of those things are built into the wall. So like if you need to stand up and remove the sitting area, you can do that. It's a really neat concept. My friend Greg Johnson sent it to me on Twitter with a little poke saying, hey, you'll probably like this. And it's very cool. Very, very cool. And another quick pick just before we move on is Moo.com. I was going to be very busy after the show tonight making new business cards because they have a sale, 25% off. I just got the email before we started the show that they're extending that sale until the 30th. It was supposed to be over today. So now it's 25% off everything as far as I know. And they do business cards, they do greeting cards, flyers, postcards, stickers even, letterhead accessories. It's such a really neat concept because it's almost print on the go. Like you have to order a set amount, but because of the way that they do their printing, you can have one back to the card. So all of your business information is going to be the same on the back of the business card, but then you can put as many fronts on it as you want. The last time I did this, I did their mini business cards, and I just had some art on the front, and then I had my information on the back, and I was able to print off, I think I did three or four different versions, I think three, and I took them to conventions with me, and so people that took my business card, it was like an engagement. They said, hey, do you have a business card? I was like, yeah, which one do you want? And then they have to choose between the puking dragon, the zombie hand holding the iPod, and I think Sam, one of my characters from my comic. And it was really cool to see people say like, oh yeah, I totally want a business card. And then they would pause and go, oh, I didn't realize I had a choice, you know, like, and so I would see quickly like, hey, the dragon is really popular. So I eventually made a print of the dragon and that sells really well. So it's cool to be able to give some of your art away rather than just having a boring business card. People can say like, okay, great. Especially if it's something the size of a business card, and you're giving the whole art away on one side, then people can leave it on their desk or stick it to their fridge just because it's neat. It's fun to have. And something that's new this round, because they did not have this the last time they had a sale, and that is square business cards. And if you are a big Instagram person or a photographer, then a square business card would be a very cool way to stand out.
Or a big square.
Or yeah, or if you happen to be square. If you have a square head, then get yourself a square business card.
Are you saying something about me, Joel? Because I kind of have a square head, and I'm kind of offended now.
I hadn't noticed the square head, honestly.
Sure,
I
mean, you hadn't.
You need like audio business cards. You need to have like, you know, the square business card with your square head, and then have Adam West read your business information.
I would like that, and I'm assuming you can make that happen, Joel. So I'm just gonna like.
I will give him a call. I'll just say like, look, my dad watched your show all the time when he was younger, and I've got this friend that needs business cards. Yeah, no, it should be fine. Be like those cards from Hallmark where you open it and they sing to you. Mm-hmm. You just got Adam West singing to you. Yeah. So what's your pick this week, sir?
Oh, it's this fun little utility I found a couple weeks ago. Basically, did you know that you can make your monitors hum?
I didn't until you sent me this link.
Yeah, it's a Thume, thume.ca/screentunes, and you go to it, and basically, oh, by the way, seizure warning. If you get seizures or something, you might not want to do this. But basically, you just load it up, you put it full screen on your monitor, and most LCD monitors will start buzzing. I'm hearing the buzzing right now. You probably can't hear it over the microphone.
No, but it's very high-pitched.
Yeah, it's just a cool party trick, but it's pretty cool at the same time, too, because who knew that you could make your monitor do that? That your monitor could act as like a tone generator?
Yeah, I didn't know. And if you're going to try it out, folks, look away. Mm-hmm. I made myself pretty dizzy before the show trying this out just to kind of see if it worked. And it doesn't work right away. It has to kind of oscillate a few times before the monitor before the monitor starts making the noise. And if you're watching it, like if you're actually looking at it full screen, it's very hard on the eyes. And I gave myself kind of a queasy headache really quick. So just be warned if you're going to try it. And I would say don't try it on like a 46-inch television. That would be a bad idea.
I have it going full screen on both monitors right now. I think I've broken into the Matrix.
Is it the blue pill or the red pill? I can never remember.
Both.
Nice. Well, that wraps up this episode of the Citadel Cafe. We record live every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on the citadelcafe.com/live. I believe our chat room is down tonight. Sorry about that, folks. I will look into that between now and the next episode. Our mobile audio stream, which is going, is provided by alphageekradio.com. You can listen to the show live on Alpha Geek Radio on your computer or your favorite mobile browser. Just head to mobile.alphageekradio.com and tune into channel 1 at showtime. There's also some help information up there on Alpha Geek Radio. If you go to alphageekradio.com and check out the help section, it'll show you how to listen on a very large number of devices, everything from an Apple TV to a PlayStation 3 to Amazon Radio, like all the different things that you might be using on your favorite device. There's a way to listen to Alpha Geek Radio. So check out alphageekradio.com and the help section for that information. Music for the show was composed by Kevin MacLeod, and this episode will be available on demand via iTunes and our website, thecitadelcafe.com. Contact the show at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com or look us up on Twitter and Facebook by name. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am up to online at joelduggan.com. Check out my Twitter feed at Joel Duggan, where I posted a bunch of sketches from books that I sold this afternoon to some very fun people that I met at the Dal Student Union Market. It was a lot of fun and a lot of cool sketches, including one of a evil Sith Sam with a lightsaber. It was a lot of fun to do. You can also check out patreon.com/JoelDuggan. That's a way to support my comic work and this very podcast. So if you're enjoying what I'm putting out there creatively, then consider a dollar a month as a way to help me create more cool stuff. Bill, where can people find you online?
Let's see, on Twitter, I'm at Bill Meeks. As far as all the podcasts and everything, we put video versions of all of them out at youtube.universebox.com. And you can read my superhero adventure series, Dog Boy Adventures, at dogboyadventures.com. I just came out with the fourth one, and the last one's coming later this year.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being on the show, man. It's always fun, and we'll try to have you on sooner than later.
Oh, yeah. Sooner, please. Please. Or later. Either way, I'm pretty open. Just let me know.
As we covered before, flattery will get you back on the show. Absolutely.
It was such a fun time, Joel. It was great. And your voice was sexy.
Right on cue. You've been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, and sexy, but you can only pick two. You know what? I'm interrupting myself.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, I just went to go to the Alpha Geek Radio reruns, and it's playing an old Citadel Cafe. From last week. You've been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, and sexy, but you can only pick two. Pick very carefully.